Hello, welcome to another episode of the Rethink Energy podcast. My name is Bogdan Avmuta, I'm the Rethink Energy editor, and today with me I have Andres Wontanar, our solar analyst.
Morning.
This show is based on our weekly issue where we analyze the events that happened in the renewable sectors of the past week. Today we will discuss two of the stories from Wednesday's issue. First one touches on Europe pursuing blue hydrogen as an alternative to green hydrogen as a means of pragmatism. We will debate if that is a good strategy or not, given the context. And we will also ask Andres if the wind industry should chase 20 megawatt wind turbines or not. First, we'll dive into my story from this week on blue hydrogen. So we have a couple of announcements in Europe, mainly the UK and one in Netherlands as well, about relatively large-scale blue hydrogen projects being announced, getting final investment decision, and generally getting the ball rolling, scaling up with operational targets of 2026 and 2027, so just around the corner. There was a specific announcement in the UK for a 600 megawatt blue hydrogen plant. Just to clarify for those who are not so familiar with the spectrum of colors of hydrogen, blue hydrogen is hydrogen produced from natural gas with carbon emissions captured, also known as CCS, carbon capture and sequestration. Now, there's a couple of problems, let's say, with blue hydrogen, and really in the context of Europe and the continent trying to secure some energy independence and increase their energy security, so to say, after the events in Ukraine over the last couple of years, it's really a step in the opposite direction from what the Russian invasion in Ukraine encouraged Europe to do, which is double down on renewables. Obviously, if you are relying on blue hydrogen, that means you're relying on natural gas. We all know how volatile natural gas prices are. So we see the same old story told in a new way, where again, Europe is linking a bunch of industrial sectors back to fossil fuels, right? So we'll never escape this vicious cycle of trade disruptions or geopolitical conflicts affecting fossil fuel prices and then affecting everything else, right? The potential with green hydrogen is that as long as you have a wind or solar generation farm with a signed PPA, power purchasing agreement, in place, then you can have a guaranteed price for that electricity, and then you can have a guaranteed price for hydrogen, which stabilizes the entire integrated supply chain, so to say. So, a couple of questionable choices, so to say, on Europe's side. Like I said, Netherlands, same early quid, is opening a plant in Rotterdam, and they're planning to take all the CO2 emissions, put them back down into oil and gas, depleted oil and gas fields.
Hmm. So will that be successful? Will this blue hydrogen agenda actually manage to be not as polluting as grey, or will that end up leaking eventually?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's the argument that those processes of steam methane reforming and autothermal reforming, which are a couple of the processes through which blue hydrogen can be produced, steam methane reforming is about 90% efficient, autothermal reforming is about 95%, 99% efficient, it varies. So none of them are 100% efficient, but you also have the problem of fugitive emissions from natural gas extraction points. So then when we're talking about carbon tax on goods and manufactured products, then the price of hydrogen, of blue hydrogen, will keep increasing to make up for the pollution. So we don't see that, for that specific reason, we don't see blue hydrogen be economically viable when in a couple of years, green hydrogen will come around. and will undercut it. So that's kind of plain and simple.
So it's a rather standard thing where the government, or governments in this case, underestimate the potential for the next future industry to actually be affordable once it exists, which it mostly doesn't right now.
Yeah, like I said in the introduction, it's all quoted as pragmatism. You know, we have to be pragmatic, and we would use green hydrogen if it was available, but it's not, so we need to double down on other things as well. Which is true, green hydrogen is not available right now. It needs a couple more years to scale up. The electrolyzer industry needs to scale up, go through some learning curve improvements, but funnily enough, it's exactly the oil and gas majors who are responsible for around a fourth of the current hydrogen demand in the world for their oil and gas refineries. We know all those companies want to decarbonize their activities. Let aside the whole discussion of does oil and gas have a future, leave that to the side. Those oil and gas majors are still investing today in electrolyzers and green hydrogen plants to decarbonize their activities, right? So there's about 200 and something gigawatts worth of electrolysis capacity that's going to be installed solely due to the oil and gas majors, and that's going to do loads of good to learning curve improvements, which will bring the cost of hydrogen down. So it's really just market dynamics that are, you know, dominoes are set in place, and we just need to wait for them to fall.
So just how bad is it? Like, are we in a situation where at least the blue hydrogen infrastructure is compatible both with the gray before it and the green ahead of it? Or are we wasting lots of money by building something that's redundant and that we have to start from scratch again in future with green?
Yeah, I mean, it's redundant in the sense that it's not going to be able to use for green, right? Because essentially what you're doing is you take a gray hydrogen plant and you just install a carbon capture and sequestration system in place, and you might have to change a couple of things, to change from steam methane reformation to orthothermal reformation. But so yes, yeah, it's a bit of an upgrade. You can obviously build it standalone as a new project, but a lot of companies like to take those gray hydrogen plants and just retrofit them, upgrade them from gray to blue, and reduce emissions. But when it comes to green hydrogen, it's apples and oranges. So in a sense, yes, we see this as a big waste on governments and companies putting in a lot of money and a lot of subsidies into this sector, which will eventually end up being too expensive just because it's not, you know, from an emissions point of view. And like I said, this is where the carbon tax will come in. It's just not good enough compared to green hydrogen. So you will have the added carbon tax on top of however cheap you get blue hydrogen to be, even if all your, you know, orthothermal reformation and carbon capture sequestration equipment goes through learning curves. You then add on top of that a carbon tax. And like I said, it's always going to be dependent on the volatility of natural gas, which is another thing, right? If we have another conflict somewhere, or something happens to the natural gas supply, and then the price of blue hydrogen skyrockets. And then you just simply, do you really want a bunch of sectors just to keep being connected to a volatile feedstock?
And it's very believable and even unsurprising if the policymakers have failed to take a broad enough view, because at least in my segment of solar, I was just chatting to Nicholas Lua of Opus yesterday, Dow Jones, and he's published some article that I haven't actually gotten around to reading it yet, but maybe I don't need to because I spoke to the author, where he looks at the IRA subsidies and the agenda to reshore manufacturing. Specifically, he was looking at Cubic PV's withdrawal from its 10 gigawatt wafer factory that it had planned. And from what I gather, his analysis is pretty simple. The price of Chinese wafers, which they make 98% of the global total right now, that's my number. His is probably might be off by different by half a percent. The price just went down by like 60% in the past year. So of course that is going to ruin any manufacturing efforts for the same thing in any market that isn't completely protected, and the US is only like semi protected because they don't want to kill their cell manufacturers by banning imports of wafers from the only people that currently make them. Here's the thing, right? I'm pretty sure if you draw a trend line of prices in the solar supply chain and you start it in like 2015 and you carry on through 2019, you see it going downwards. Then you have the pandemic and the war and everything became more expensive. I think really almost every product on the planet probably had some kind of price disruption. So, and then you have these policymakers designing the IRA subsidies in like, I forget when exactly it was now, but it was probably 2022 or something, right in the middle of the price peak. Maybe they just should have looked at the 2015 to 2019 price trend and extrapolated it, because none of these price increases were intrinsic to the solar industry, which in fact was very clearly and manifestly going through a period of incredible production capacity expansion. So in the US, you have people designing this. How big was the IRA? It was like several trillion dollars, wasn't it? And they just failed to, I mean, I'm sure the solar manufacturing aspect wasn't that big, but they failed to just forecast something without getting it conflated with that time that shipping costs went to $20,000 a pop because of Shanghai being on lockdown or something. And so compared to that, it's a lot less outrageous for the Europeans to fail to make the leap of faith to green.
Like Peter always used to say, it's politicians lacking scientific degrees who are always making this scientifically based decisions influenced by lobbies and so on. But moving on to the other issue that we will discuss on today's show is a story you wrote, Andreas. Should the wind industry scale to 20 megawatt wind turbines? What is the verdict, Andreas?
So this is quite a fun one for me, at least. Now, wind isn't even something I normally cover, but I keep a little bit of an eye on it because I look at the Chinese energy news in general.
Yeah, I think we bounce it between the two of us.
Yeah, I might cover it a bit more in future, if I'm allowed. Anyway, I've been seeing, it seems like every year the Chinese come out with something even bigger on turbine sizes. And they are now, I think in the past week I saw some 800 megawatt offshore Chinese wind project that where the individual turbines are 14 megawatts. And I think 10 megawatts is still pretty big worldwide. And I think the Western standard, I think that's probably the Western standard for a Western offshore farm. But the Chinese are, they've got several, they've got 14 megawatts being quite common. They've got maybe half a dozen companies looking into 16 megawatt and 18 megawatt. And they're the biggest companies as well, at least within China. And then you've got Goldwind, Envision Energy, and Mingyang Smart Energy that are now conducting R&D on 20 megawatt turbines. And I believe Goldwind is the biggest in the world. And the natural assumption is, well, bigger must be better. That's why it's an R&D project. That's why it's something that took until now to figure out how to build it without it breaking itself. And, you just have a bigger sweep area and it extends higher into the atmosphere, which is probably a good thing because I'm pretty sure the wind gets a bit stronger, a bit higher up. So you'd think it's just a good thing. But apparently there is some complaining about this. Now, it's coming from Westerners, and the Westerners are gradually losing the wind industry to the Chinese because their cost of production is a bit higher. And so they're already a bit annoyed at the Chinese for that. But also specifically when your margins are lower, that means you're less able to constantly reinvest in production capacity with all these different mold sizes and sizes for everything. And so it's a real, so you could spin this as sour grapes. But I couldn't do this because the two people who have brought this narrative to the fore were Andrew Garrard, and Henrik Stiesdal. And they've just recently received a prestigious prize for their innovations in wind power, which go back decades. These are foundational figures in the industry. I think Stiesdal is still the chief technology officer at Siemens Wind Power, and Garrard has had quite a varied career that's comparable. And so these people really, really know what they are talking about. Now, I get the impression that if I've wanted to, and if I'm feeling mischievous, and this is just a silly narrative, really, that I'm making up for fun, you could say that Stiesdal has a bit of sour grapes because he wants the EU to place restrictions on maximum wind turbine size. And of course, that's kind of anti-China if they're the ones making them. But then Andrew Garrard, on the other hand, I was looking at his LinkedIn profile, and what do I see? But an article called why can't we be more like China? Or what if we were more like China? And he's chumming it up over in China with all his colleagues in the wind industry and saying, wow, they're doing so well. And look at how much they install. So, you know, you can't really say the same thing about him. So then the question becomes, if it's not sour grapes, because these are two of the most august figures in the industry, and it's not really my place to accuse them of just being sour, you know, they must have a good reason. Well, then what is it? And here's where you come to the sort of question of technological capability, because it is still the case that China is catching up on the West on many things. In other words, they still have a technological lag. And something I read while I was writing this article, actually on Chinese industry media, is that they still rely on Western suppliers for the software, which is not terribly relevant here, but also a lot of physical components like main shaft bearings and lubricants and carbon fiber supply to a significant extent. You know, obviously China attempts to reshore these things, but it takes time. And it just, we know that there is a technological lag that has gone back really centuries, really, and maybe it will only last a few more decades, but it still exists for now. And so here's the alternative explanation other than sour grapes, which is that the Chinese are simply willing to tolerate more breakages of an imperfect technology. Because, you know, why are they the ones building these new, innovative, more powerful, more advanced turbines if they're actually not the side with the more advanced technology? And they have to import some crucial parts from the West still. Well, you know, partly it could be they have more margins, so they're more able to invest in new manufacturing because it is China after all. But it may also be this idea that they're causing more breakages and they just tolerate that more than in the West. And it could be that they're trying to, you know, get eyes on their product, and maybe these are actually still experimental. They're going to build them. The warranty may bite them in an unpleasant place if the wind turbine breaks under it, or maybe unfortunately it'll break a little bit after the warranty. Either way is not really good. So that's the two sides of the story, really.
I think from like an industry point of view, the things that I heard is that because some OEMs are calling for more of a standardization of the design and placing sort of a cap on capacity, right, which, like you said, directly affects the dimensions of the turbine. Because if one OEM comes in with a 20 plus megawatt turbine and the others are, you know, still using 10, 12, 14 megawatt turbines, then you have a significant size difference. So then that specific OEM needs their own ships designed to transport those turbines offshore, different port facilities. So it's not really helping the whole, you know, race to 2015 at zero wind targets, etc.
I mean, that is something I forgot to mention just now. It's not just the investment cost or the question of how reliable this is. It is also the compatibility throughout the supply chain. And in solar, which of course I'm much more familiar with, even there they have pretty big efforts by the giants to come together and restrict or standardize what they're making. And that's for a lot of different reasons. I mean, the sizes of the components are one thing. Also, how efficiently they stack into shipping containers. You know, it must be so much, and that's solar, which has no moving parts, and where, okay, you're stacking it in a shipping container, but how big is it compared to, these are small elements compared to a shipping container, so you can always find a decent filling full factor. Turbines, unimaginably more difficult when you're dealing with 16 versus 18 versus 20. It must be an incredible nuisance for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, so I think that's from like an industry point of view. From the finance point of view, I guess like with any new technology, the way it usually works with, because you touched on insurance and bankability, is in order for an investor or bank to give you, you know, the loan for the capital investment to actually build a new technology, you need to go to them with, you know, an insurance or rather an insurer that has agreed to insure your design and your project, and that's all based on the way you get insurance for those things is based on standards, right? So if you come in and you say I want insurance for a 20 megawatt turbine, whatever, maybe a gigafactory or a project, they'll say, well, we don't really know what to compare this with. And this is something that the electrolysis sector is kind of like dealing with, and why we're seeing so many projects not really getting financial investment decision, because it's hard to get all the signature on the money paper, so to say. So I'm assuming this is a similar story to wind one, such a new and different technology, well, different in the sense of size, like we mentioned, comes into play.
Yeah. And of course, I think this plea to stop increasing things and making them bigger will fall on deaf ears to some extent in China. At best, they'll stop at 20 megawatts for a while.
There
will be this contrast.
It might be a case of, you know, some 20 megawatt designs springing up from the ground here and there, being installed in some projects. But then, like we said, the rest of the of the sector that is going to support the wind installations directly, like we mentioned, the ships and the port infrastructure, etc., will choose to standardize for a smaller dimension, simply because by that point, when we'll see a couple of 20 megawatt designs emerge, so much money would have been poured into ports and ships and infrastructure and workforce and things like this, that there won't be essentially no incentive for everybody to start putting money again into upgrading everything yet again. But it's free to dream for any OEM that wants to build bigger. But anyway, let's move on to a couple of short items from our World of Renewables this week section.
Well, one thing I've just noticed is that way back at the start of, you know, a few months back, I put my end of 2024 module price forecast at 13 cents per watt, but my price tracking has just come to 12.9 cents per watt. It's probably going to fall a little bit further, so I have to decline my forecast again. At least the polysilicon one is still surviving, but yeah, I really did underestimate the price fall a little bit. No, I knew it would happen though.
Well, perhaps a small adjustment. Yeah, so I was writing about this announcement about this European company. They're a Portuguese / Irish, it's a weird combination, electrolysis company, Fusion Fuel, which they have this integrated solar electrolyzer design. We essentially have a small solar panel integrated with an electrolyzer in one unified design. And they've been contracted to install those designs for a 630 megawatt facility in Europe. I think it's in Portugal. I won't attempt to spell that. Sines, Science, I don't know how you spell it, but it's a town in Portugal. So yeah, I mean, we kind of saw those, we often see these kind of like hybrid designs. I was writing about a battery electrolyzer hybrid design. I think it was called Battleizer or something like that. we never quite see those in a good light, because I think it doesn't really make sense to take two components that are so complex, trying to master them both, under one.
Especially if the facility itself is 630 megawatts anyway.
Yeah, so we never quite see those companies. Interesting ideas, but like I said, it's quite hard to master even one of them. And there'll be so many companies that will fail to master one of those designs, let alone doing two at the same time and putting them together, integrating them.
Well, I had another perovskite little announcement. And I spoke to Halo Cell recently. I think I'll publish the article with them next week. It's my turn again. And one of the things he pointed out is why perovskites are decent on satellites. Because I was saying to him, well, if gallium arsenide is more powerful and more expensive, surely that's what you use on satellites, because you're already paying an incredible amount for the satellite. So surely the photovoltaic cost cannot be significant. And he told me for the small low Earth orbit satellites, like weather surveillance and such like, the gallium arsenide is actually a very large fraction. I think he even said half, although you know, that's an incredible amount. And so that's why it's valid to have these companies looking at perovskites. And that might be one of the first avenues that perovskites get commercialized on. And a funny thing is, it's actually easier to make the perovskites work in space than it is on the ground, because there's no humidity or oxygen to ruin them. So we've got yet another aerospace perovskite company. I think there's several of them now.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with satellites is you definitely want something high quality and reliable up there, because you can't really service it if things go wrong, and that is the only power source for a satellite.
Yeah.
So but it's a highly also, critical part.
What I hear from perovskite companies is that all the sudden collapse of cell power output is always a failure of the encapsulation. But in space, you fail the do they even bother with encapsulation? I guess they probably might as well, but there's no oxygen and humidity, so the degradation may actually work, may actually not really be there so much out there. And because of course perovskites are such a complicated molecule, there's so many potential interactions, unless you're in space.
Okay, well, and that go on.
So another big one is the European Solar Manufacturing Council holding a trilogue, which is some sort of Byzantine European Union legislative advisory structure. So they had a couple of members of the European Parliament there. They had a whole number of NGOs representing the Uyghurs. And they're talking about forced labor and blocking Xinjiang and supply chain tracing. And it's just one more thing where we'll see if the EU actually ever does anything. your article that we just discussed was about the EU choosing the boring option, the bland option of blue hydrogen, where they just kick the can down the road. You know, it's frustrating to see them talk about things, regardless of whether you want them to do anything or not. It's just it's kind of this constant annoyance of will they, won't they? And I'm starting to wonder if I should just assume by default that they never will when they talk about something. Even the US with its IRA isn't able to reshore wafers or open new polysilicon. And also maybe the next set of elections in the US means that the IRA can't get upgraded or even might get rolled back a little bit. And then you are left with an IRA solar manufacturing agenda, which only really went to modules and cells and maybe some lucky perovskite manufacturers that get to sneakily claim wafer production credits while they're kind of on a different technology, really. So if that's the best the US can do, maybe, Europe's in a much worse position. Anyway, go ahead.
No, perhaps. No, I agree with you. But anyway, this seems like a good point to wrap it up. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us for the show. And hopefully we'll see you next week. This is a weekly show. And like I said, this is all based on the articles that we write as as part of our weekly publication, which you can find online at rethinkresearch.biz. That's B-I-Z. You go and click on energy and weekly analysis. You can also find some of the forecasts that we might have mentioned in today's show on the forecast and data. And please do get in touch with us if you have any questions or any discussions, or if you just want to say hi. We always appreciate it. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.